to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
I want to begin introducing our guest today and the subject we're going to cover by reading a paragraph from his book about the subject of complexity theory. And I encourage you, dear listener, to stick with me and try, as I did when first reading it, to be open to its perspective. And please know I'm interspersing the reading with a few guiding comments of my own. So here's the paragraph. Causal generalizations about how we are all one with the universe are so common these days as to be trite. Our guest goes on to write, our habitual experiences of the material world and our Western culture bias toward materialism, that the world is only its physical substance, continually push us in the other direction. So here he's talking about the pressures of conventional wisdom making it hard to delve deeply into the idea that we are all one with the universe. So now here, dear listener, is the kicker to this perspective. He says, but complexity theory woven together with relativity and quantum mechanics tells us a different story. Oneness is very real and very true. And while separation is also true, it is not any more true than oneness. They are a complementarity. Each, though different, is equally indispensable for a full comprehension of reality. So now our guest takes us to the crux of the matter when he concludes, this conviction comes not only from a subset of philosophies, or from ancient religions, or from New Age mystics, but from modern, contemporary, empirical science. So I hope your appetite is whetted for the coming conversation with our guest today, Dr. Neil Theis. Dr. Neil Theis is a practicing pathologist and leading stem cell researcher, as well as an explorer in the nature of consciousness and its relationship to us and the cosmos, as revealed in complexity theory. Dr. Theis is also a senior student of Zen Buddhism at the Village Zendo in New York City, under the guidance of Roshi Inkyo O'Hara. He is the author of Notes on Complexity, A Scientific Theory of Connection, Consciousness, and Being. Join us for the next hour as we explore the science of complexity and of consciousness and its relation to our everyday life with our guest, Dr. Neil Theis. I'm speaking with Neil from his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Neil, welcome.
Thank you, Justine. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you too. I'm just excited about this conversation. I think I'd like to start first with a little bit of a description about the prevailing scientific theory or the prevailing bias that exists in Western culture. It's materialism. What is this theory?
Basically, that everything, every phenomenon we find in the universe, every experience we have, it's assumed that it arises from the material universe through the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, the properties of biology. Of course, many things do exactly that. But it posits that the material reality of existence, made up of whatever the smallest subatomic particles, fields, strings, whatever we call those are, that those are sufficient to explain everything. And there's nothing behind that or beneath that. And, you know, I was raised a materialist. I was a nerdy science kid. And I thought, yeah, if you figure out enough of physics, you figure out everything. And at the same time, I was raised in an observant Jewish household, more observant than most American Jews, but not Orthodox. My parents were European, and I'm a first-generation American, so they came here after World War II. My father was from Germany, so this was in the context of being a child of Holocaust survivors. And my brother and I and the children in our community were not subjected to our religion for the most part. We were nurtured, we were treasured, because we were the future that these people thought they would never have. And so I was raised in a very comfortable, warm, nurturing religious environment. And so I grew up with that as well. So I was a nerdy kid, and I was really interested in science, geology, astronomy. I bumped into relativity and quantum physics in seventh grade, so fairly early for most people. But I had some good teachers. And I was a math nerd. I was on the math team. And so I had a strong inclination that physics and mathematics could explain everything. And yet at the same time, I had a deeply spiritual inclination. I never felt that these were in tension with each other. Even though our culture says they're supposed to be in tension with each other, I just never felt like it. That didn't speak to me. I joke that it may be because I was a Gemini and I sort of had that personality anyways. But I sort of kept...
I love it that a scientist is now referring to astrology, that you're a Gemini. I love it. Thank you.
Well, I like to say, I don't believe in astrology, but astrology believes in me.
So, lovely.
What can I do? It's at least a good metaphor for much of me. So I pursued my spiritual life on one path. There was a time I was thinking about becoming a rabbinical student. I eventually, sort of yearning for a more direct experience of things, found Jewish mysticism was not really available to a middle-class, non-Orthodox kid growing in the New England suburbs. But I bumped into Zen Buddhism after a while, and here is what seemed to me at the time a kind of neutral mysticism, that I could mix with the Jewish stuff. The reports of mystical experiences in the Zen literature was similar to what I had read in reports from Jewish mystical literature. So I thought, okay, maybe I can get it that way. Meanwhile, I was also majoring in computer science in college, and I had a pre-med minor, and I went to medical school and wound up pursuing the scientific paths that way. So with the medicine, I guess where we started with this is the whole idea of materialism. The only time I experienced any tension was usually speaking to classmates. And pretty much this didn't happen until I got to medical school, where I had classmates who had come up in strong religious traditions of their own that they had rejected for whatever reasons and could not understand. They were aghast at the idea that I kept kosher, that I was a Sabbath observer, that I talked about meditating. They just thought this was ridiculous. And I was like, all right, that's how you feel. Not, these are not issues for me. And they weren't issues. So I pursued both paths with, I'd say, equal passion until I found them weaving together, which came as a surprise. I was not looking for science to inform my spiritual perspective, and I wasn't looking for the spiritual perspective to change my materialist views. But they did. And it was when I encountered complexity theory that that really started to happen.
I'm thinking that part of this began for you as a cellular biologist. I'm maybe not biologist, but studying cells. And you discovered something about, well, cells are not like building blocks that you just kind of stack them up one by one and you build them. You discovered something else about cellular biology or the way that they work in our bodies.
Yeah. So in medicine, what I ultimately chose to go into was pathology, and in particular, anatomic pathology, which means I look at microscope slides made from tissues. And for me, I'm a specialist in liver pathology in even greater specificity, so that if someone has a liver tumor and we want to know, is it cancer, not cancer, it might get biopsied and I'll look at it under the microscope, do some tests on it to determine what the diagnosis is. I'm involved in liver transplants. So does a person need a transplant? What's the cause for their liver failure after they've got a transplant? It's not working. Do they have rejection? Do they have a recurrence of disease? Something new coming in? I help make these diagnoses by looking at tissues under the microscope. So what I'm interested in scientifically, what I'm trained in, is something for which we don't really have a name. We talk about molecular biology and cell biology, but what pathologists do is tissue biology. We're looking at the microscope at how all the cells within the tissue are arranged and interacting with each other. And we know what the normal interactions should look like, the normal arrangements and shapes and colors. And we've learned over decades of study, when this gets altered, what is disease? And what can we say about that disease in terms of where it comes from or what the prognosis is? So my interest clinically has been, how do cells organize themselves into tissues? Where I started getting a little more hardcore basic science was looking at human liver cells. We started to get an idea, me and the people I work with, that the liver had stem cells, which had been an arguable thing for many years.
Well, I'm going to have to interrupt you for just one moment, and we're going to come back to the liver stem cells in just one moment. But I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Neil Theis, and he's the author of Notes on Complexity, A Scientific Theory of Connection, Consciousness, and Being. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, neilthiesofficial.com. And he spells his name Neil, N-E-I-L-T-H-E-I-S-E, Neil Theis, neilthiesofficial.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Neil Feese, and you were just mentioning about liver stem cells. And when you, yes. So I left our listeners hanging on the edge of their seats.
So I spend my day looking under the microscope at human tissues, and in particular liver tissues, but tissues from all parts of the body from time to time. And what I noticed is that the way cells within the tissue were appearing in different disease states implied that the liver probably did have stem cells. This is around the year 2000, turn of the millennium. And at that point, people thought really only the skin, the lining of the digestive tract, the blood and bone marrow had stem cells, and other organs, the brain, the heart certainly did not. Maybe the liver did, but most people thought not. We now know that every organ has stem cells. That's become a commonplace, but it really became a commonplace from the time I was involved in this, as well as some other people. And we started noticing that some of the stem cells for the liver seemed to not just come from within the liver, but from the circulation, from the blood, maybe coming from the bone marrow. And there were a whole group of people at the time finding similar things for different organs. And we were part of this movement about adult stem cell plasticity, that adult cells could move around the body from organ to organ and become cells of other organs, of other tissues, in ways we thought had not been possible. There was a lot more diversity in human tissues and a lot more creativity in human tissues and in all tissues of any species than we had thought. So that was exciting. And through that work, I had been introduced by a friend to an artist named Jane Prophet, who had been herself interested in how people interact with virtual creatures in online environments.
I just want to say I love this part of your book when you talk about Jane Prophet and what her research was showing and how it dovetailed with what you were experiencing in your field.
Yeah, I have a big smile on my face right now because this is my favorite part, too. It was an amazing time. It was an amazing experience. So she was this artist that had, with a collaborator, had created this online environment called Technosphere. And this was very primitive online stuff. This is about 25 years ago. And you would create a little creature and send it out into the world called Technosphere, and it would be an herbivore or a carnivore. And there were other characteristics that you would specify in advance. And then you would get little email postcards from your creature telling you what it was up to. So today I grazed. Today I outran a carnivore. I survived. Today I got impregnated. I had a baby. Today I did not outrun a carnivore and I died. And this is your last postcard. And what they had found was that when there were thousands of people's creatures out in Technosphere moving around, that behavior started to arise that they had not planned or coded for in the programming. So the herbivores started to form herds. And one thing that they noticed was that population would fluctuate up and down as any sort of general population might, then all of a sudden the population would become really stable for a while and then suddenly crash. And the crash was a die-off of herbivores. And they didn't know what was happening because they hadn't programmed this.
So these are the grazers crashing.
Yeah. So the grazers had formed a herd, grazed themselves into a closed valley, and the carnivores had lined up at the mouth of the valley waiting. And when the grazers had eaten all the grass in the valley and tried to leave, the carnivores jumped on them and there was a sudden population collapse because they all got devoured. And there were many things like this where things appeared in Technosphere that they had not programmed. And that got the attention of people who at the time were talking about artificial life. And Jane told me how she was told by these folks that they had created an artificial life program. And she said, no, it's an artificial life program. It's not really artificial life. And they were like, no, It's artificial life. Technosphere is alive. And so when she and I started talking, the idea was to just put a scientist and an artist in a room together to let them talk and see what comes of it. This was funded by the Wellcome Trust, and a mutual friend of ours curated us, Peter Ride, who was then at the University of Westminster. And the idea was to put us together for some number of days, record what we would say, and let other people study how we spoke to each other. But it turned out we had a really creative, productive collaboration. So when I told her about how stem cells were behaving and moving around the body and interacting and creating tissues and stuff, she said, oh, that sounds to me like complexity theory. And I said, what's complexity? And she said, well, it's like the animals, the creatures of technosphere, or how ants form colonies. And then she started to talk about how ants have these very complex, literally complex communities with all sorts of organizational structures and behaviors, but there's no ant at the top planning everything. It's not a top-down structure. It all is bottom-up, arising from how each individual ant interacts with every other ant. And out of those interactions, which have certain characteristics, you get this complex organization, which, like the creatures of technosphere, like cells in the body, are adaptive. They can evolve and adapt if the environment changes. And so this is how I got introduced to complexity theory. It was from Jane. And so we started doing some writing and actually doing some programming with some other collaborators to see if we could describe cells as members of a complex system. And that brought me to complexity theory, and that was 20 years ago, and complexity hasn't let go of me yet.
Yeah. Now, what I found really exciting about this whole theory, and when the two of you described the ant colonies and what happened there and how the ant colonies survived beyond the technosphere of the herbivores and carnivores, because they died out, because there's something that happens. And I'm just so excited about this, because I think this is the most creative part of being human, is what is called quenched disorder, or those errant ants that don't follow the rest of the ants, and something happens. They cross paths and they go across the paths and they do something else. So tell us what quenched disorder is and how it might be applied to our own human creativity.
Sure. So it's one of my favorite things too. Quenched disorder is sort of the technical term for it. What it means is that if you look at a food line of ants that looks like a straight line going from the sugar cube someone dropped on the ground on one side to the ant colony on the other, and the ants are going back and forth, there's always some ants that aren't following the line. And so when I was a kid and I would find an errant ant in my mother's kitchen, I would feel terribly sorry for this poor ant that obviously was not evolutionarily with it, because it wasn't doing a job. It was out of my mother's kitchen. And so I would get it on a piece of paper. I was a proto-Buddhist, and I would take it outside. And I knew if my mother saw that ant, she'd immediately call it, she would kill it, and then immediately call the exterminator. But she was right, because that errant ant wasn't just lost. It was the ant that was likely to bump into some food in my mother's kitchen and return to the colony, laying down the root for all the other ants to stream into her kitchen. So when you see a straight food line in an ant colony and some ants aren't following it, those 2 or 3% of the ants that aren't following the line aren't evolutionarily poorly adaptive. They're the ones that are likely to find the new food source when this food source runs out. So there's got to be a little disorder in the system. If there's only disorder, ants don't organize at all. Humans don't organize at all. Nothing organizes. You just have disorder. If you have no randomness, then there's no way for the system to change how it's responding if the environment changes, such as if the sugar cube is used up. when that sugar cube is used up, someone in the colony has to be finding another sugar cube. It's going to be those ants that aren't following the line that are likely to bump into something. So it's this limited randomness that's really key that all complex systems share, whether we're talking about humans in a human society, ants in an ant colony, cells in a body. We all share that there's got to be a limited range of randomness, another phrase for it being this quenched disorder.
So my question, going back to the early part of our conversation, you were looking at liver cells. And mm-hmm. then you said, well, there are these other cells that come in, maybe from bone marrow or something. Mm-hmm. These other cells that come in. Are those errant cells? Are those quenched disorder cells that even in our body it takes place?
You're good. Bingo. So when I was talking to Jane, part of what I was talking to her about was exactly this. People would say that, well, maybe there are some stem cells for the liver or the heart or the kidney or the brain or the muscle that can come from the bone marrow. But even if they're there, they're very few. They're trivial. And our answer to that, we wrote this in a paper, is that it's not trivial. In fact, it's vital. It's literally vital because this is what allows our tissues. You have to have layers of adaptation to survive if there's disease, if there's aging, if there's wounding. So that this small amount that we were seeing, people wanted to dismiss it because it was a very rare finding in normal tissues. But we could show experimentally that if there was the right kind of injury, no, this really became a dominant form of repair. So that's precisely it. Looking at the cellular level in stem cell behavior, this kind of adult stem cell plasticity we realized was it's a form of quenched disorder. This is how tissues repair themselves.
And it's like vital in all livingness in some ways.
Yes.
I mean, if you don't have it, then we're like the herbivores in that little valley. And with the carnivores waiting to just destroy us.
Well, I didn't say that all the herbivores died. Some of them may have gotten away.
Errants.
Right. What we're more likely, then that's a mass extinction event. And that's a whole other thing we can also talk about. But the key thing here is that we're not machine-like. It's that little bit of randomness that makes us not machines.
Great.
An air conditioner will constantly do the same thing over and over again, even if it gets to 150 degrees out or it gets to minus 20 degrees. The air conditioner can only do what it does until it breaks.
Exactly. I'm here with Dr. Neil Theis. He's a pathologist and also a philosopher of complex theory. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Neil Theis, and he is the author of Notes on Complexity, a Scientific Theory of Connection, Consciousness, and Being. I'd like to take us to another subject.